week of January 12th, 2020, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 476, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz. Hey, Sperling, we lost out on another job.
What are you talking about? I'm still just as not looking for a job as I was last week.
Well, wait a second. Did you actually send the email?
What email?
The email to the Academy saying we are available to co-host the Oscars.
I did. And they said,
it would be like Siskel and Ebert, except podcasting. So it'd be cool. I'll even let your name go first, Sperling and Michael, even though obviously I should be first.
Well, you know, they did say, listen, guys, we love you guys. We listen to you every week. However, look, our show is long enough. Okay. And with you
knowing
two,
your track record,
the thing is going to be 9 hours long.
Another job I'm hoping for, and I hope it's only 10 or 20 years from now, is Jeopardy. I wouldn't mind being the host of Jeopardy. That's a great show. That's a great gig. And Alex Trebek is doing a great job. I actually watched the primetime Jeopardy tournament. It's still ongoing. There isn't a winner yet. It was a lot more fun than I expected. And it was kind of fun. And you know what? It's a big hit. 15 million people were watching it last week in prime time. I don't know about Live Plus 7, but right off the bat overnights, they were getting 15 million people watching Jeopardy in prime time.
Now, I would like television networks to take note. This does not mean that people want to see Jeopardy every single night in prime time. It means there was a special event, and a lot of people watch that special event.
Well, they're bringing that back, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and with celebrity contestants competing for charity, and they are doing it as a limited run event, which is the way they should go. Jimmy Kimmel's going to host. They're going to just do it for 2 weeks and then stop and then do it for 2 weeks again, just like the original show. And that's the way to go. ABC, in fact, made a big deal. There's the television events are happening right now where they dog and pony show, where they tell everyone what they're doing for the season. And some of the big stuff was, we're never having pilot season again. And also, we need event programming. And ABC is like, every month, if not more so, we're going to have a big event in prime time, like a live event, like, you know, the Live All in the Family, Live Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and a special event that's not airing all the time, live musicals, live dramas. So they're going to be doing this all the time. They recognize that's, you know, it's going back to the beginning of TV where they had live stuff constantly. That's how.
And we're also going to be sponsored by cigarettes.
That would be great. So that's what's happening in TV. We won't be hosting the Oscars. That's, you know, it's all right. But we are hosting our podcast. And what are we going to talk about this week?
Well, before, and I always do this, you always like throw to me.
Oh, wait, is there a show next week?
Yes, there is.
Oh, okay.
Actually, you know what?
Oh, what?
Actually, it's a good thing. Unless we record on Sunday, there might not be.
Well,
because the ICTA conference, which I am one of the moderators, is next week. And so if you're there at the ICTA, the International Cinema Technology Association Seminar Series in Los Angeles, please do say hello. But it's on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday.
Well, what is there a panel you're hosting or working on or a thing you're excited for seeing?
On mini theaters. I'm moderating the panel on mini theaters.
The ones we talk about in China?
Yes, correct.
And is anybody starting one in the United States? Are they in Europe?
Not yet. In Europe, yes. In Eastern Europe, especially.
Okay. What about Western Europe? Any countries with mini theaters yet?
No, not yet.
Interesting.
Not yet.
Is it on the boards? Are people launching businesses? Is anybody planning?
Well, the question is, what is working? What is not working? Where are they? Why is it working in those locations? How is it working in those locations? What is the technology that helps it work in those locations?
Like digital, or are they using Blu-ray? Or So is it? Yeah. Do you know the answers, or will you find out?
A little bit of both. I've moderated one panel on this previously, so I'm hoping to find out that something new has occurred.
Well, I'm available Sunday, so maybe we'll record on Sunday. Right now, we're recording on Monday, right after the Oscar nominations. I know we'll be covering that. What else this week?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we are standing at the top, the very peak of awards season.
I'm getting dizzy.
Nominations have been announced by the visual effects folks, by the writers and directors guilds. Winners have been announced. Not nominations, but winners have been announced by the Critics' Choice Awards. But people, come on, you waited way too late. The Oscar nominations came out this morning, and we want to add our two cents to the millions of comments that have already been made, and it's only been like an hour and a half. We'll be brief, and by that, We're just kidding. On Inside Baseball, a new standard could make TVs a lot friendly when it comes to showing movies. And the people behind Quibi are pulling back the curtain to reveal more about their bite-sized platform. I hope it's covered in caramel. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on last week's box office. And those last words, those last four words, are very important.
That's right. Star Wars: The Rise of Skywalker is at $71 million worldwide. It's at $990 million and counting. And that means, of course, it will get to $1.1, $1.2 billion. And I believe it was nominated for sound mixing or sound editing. Now, what would be an example of what we just did?
Well, actually, what we just did is...
Turned on my microphone.
Yes, I said, you know, Michael, you really sound like you're really far away. And Michael said, what's this button on? Oh, I'll press that. Oh, and all of a sudden, you sounded great.
So now, sound mixing, sound editing, here we are. Next year, that will be one category. But right now, we are at 100%, so we've got good sound. So let's move on. At number two around the world is Jumanji, The Next Level. $61 million worldwide. That's at $670 million. At number three, here's a great big success story, 1917. It might have been an art film. It might have been one for old people, but it's proving a big box office hit. They pushed it as an action film. They got almost 50% young people headed to this movie. It grossed $56 million worldwide this week. It's at $60 million and counting because it's been in limited release in a few countries. It has a long way to go. It won the Golden Globe for Best Picture. It just got a ton of Oscar nominations. So this film is perfectly poised to use Oscar to triumph at the worldwide box office.
And it is really a film. I mean, last year, the films that were up against the front runner, for all intents and purposes, at the Oscars, and the front runner was Roma last year. And everybody said, whoa, but will the Academy honor a Netflix movie that only appeared in certain theaters and was in limited release and it was hard to see in theaters and everybody saw it on Netflix? Will they honor it?
And they did. They gave it Best International Film. And
that's right.
Yeah.
And they also gave it Best Director. They gave it, I think, three awards. And they, you know, gave it a ton of nominations. And then when it came time for, you know, the big prize, could it win Best Picture? No, it went to Green Book. But that said... That said, it, you know...
What does that have to do with 1917?
Well,
it's not a Netflix film.
Correct. So last year, everybody said, oh, they wimped out and gave it to some film that didn't deserve it. 1917, for all intents and purposes, people are saying is a really good movie.
Yeah. It's not a Netflix film.
Right. I'm sorry. Sorry. I guess I should have stated, you know, this year, everybody thought The Irishman, which is a Netflix film, was the front runner, and... Who could beat it out? Well, it could possibly be 1917.
Or Joker, or Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Or or Parasite, which is an international language film.
Well, when you put it that way,
yeah,
fine.
It's not. There's no front runner. There's like four movies that have 10 or 11 nominations. Joker, 1917, The Irishman, and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. So there's no clear front runner this year. No film is like, and Roma was never like the clear lock front runner where people were shocked it didn't win. They thought it was a possibility, but that was going to be making history. So yeah, no, I don't think that tracks. But yes, 1917 is doing great. You love to be in the conversation. You love people to head and see your movie in a theater and have a good time. So that helps a lot when they're looking at Joker and people who go, oh, it's a little violent, or The Irishman, they fell asleep or whatever. Maybe 1917 will triumph. So I think you're right that it's well poised to have a great Oscar night. Not well poised is Frozen 2. That did not get a nomination for Best Animated Film, but it made another $46 million. It's at $1,370 million. And number five, another big hit franchise, Ip Man 4, The Finale. That made, I think, another $36 million. I think it's at $168 million worldwide. It has at least $135, $140 million in China alone. I just got those charts this morning. They don't come out till Monday morning. So next week, we'll be way behind on China charts. And that means we're going to miss a number of films because there's three or four films on here with total grosses that were well underreported until I saw those charts. But Ip Man is doing great. So is Little Women, up for Best Picture. That made $27 million this week. That's at $107 million worldwide. Now, one of the trades said, oh, it passed the all-important and you know, prestigious $100 million worldwide box office benchmark. And I'm like, okay, that was like 50 years ago. That was a benchmark. I understand for this film and the budget of $40 million, that's great. It's going to triple its budget. That means it's a big success story. So I'm not comparing its box office to, you know, the Avengers, but is $100 million meaningful? It is, depending on your budget, but, you know.
Yeah, I don't know who said that, but it used to be
Variety or the Hollywood Reporter.
If you made $100 million, especially in the United States.
Yeah, you were a blockbuster.
You were a blockbuster.
You were and huge, one of the biggest hits of all time.
And at Show West, they used to, and they still do this, by the way. At Show West, they used to have what is referred to as the $100 million reel. And there used to be like 10 films on it. Now, the thing is like 45 minutes long. It's practically a movie unto itself, yeah, because almost every film passes $100
million. The $100 million weekend would be more exclusive.
Right.
But that is great news for Little Women, especially given the context of how much it costs to be made. So good for them. Spies in Disguise is chugging along. That's the Blue Sky animated film picked up by Disney. It grossed $27 million this week. Is that
well, you know that they actually bought the entire studio to get that film.
Well, yes. $115 million and counting. Knives Out, they got a writing nomination for Rian Johnson. Other than that, no real love at the Oscar time. I wouldn't have expected it to do so. But it made $18 million this week. It's at $265 million worldwide. And now it's a franchise.
Are you actually,
we talked about last week.
Yeah, it could be a franchise.
Of course it could. You got a great detective going with his outrageous accent, wandering around through ensembles of megastars.
And thank you for saying outrageous rather than what you said last week, which caused me to have to actually bring up my little boing boing stinger to bleep it out.
And number nine is the first Chinese film on our list that would have slipped through the cracks. We have Ip Man 4 higher up, but right here is Adoring. This is a Chinese romantic drama about young people, people of all ages, I guess, but they're people who love their pets. It's an ode to pets. It grossed $18 million this week and set $81 million and counting. Right below that is Sheep Without a Shepherd. That's the Chinese crime drama where people are trying to cover up an accidental death, murder. $14 million it made this week. It looks to be at about $150 million worldwide. Golly, I forgot to look this up. Tolo Tolo, the Italian comedy. It made $14 million this week. It's at $45 million and counting. But what it's about, I forget.
It's about somebody who stutters, apparently. Tolo Tolo.
Ah, yes. You and the Monty Python people making jokes of stuttering. At number 12 is Underwater.
Well, I can tell you exactly what it's about, according to IMDb.
Please do.
It's about Checo, a failed entrepreneur who seeks a new life as a waiter on a holiday village in Africa.
Oh, but that's right. That's the movie where he gets on the wrong. He goes to Africa and he's going to start a new life because he's bankrupt. And then there he decides it's not working out. So he gets in with a bunch of, it's a refugee comedy and it's a refugee, but he doesn't want to go back to Italy. He doesn't want to go anywhere else. He wants to go to, like, I think Monte Carlo or so. He's like trying to become a refugee going to some luxurious place. It's a hilarious comedy about refugees.
And ISIS, apparently.
Yes, exactly. $45 million that has made so far. Most of it, I assume, in Italy. And number 12 is Underwater, the sci-fi flick. Or is it sci-fi? It is, right?
It's like a sci-fi horror flick.
Uh-huh. That made $14 million on its opening week. And number 13 is The Grudge. That made another $12 million. That's at $30 million in counting. So, yes, just like Little Women is about to triple its budget. That's exactly what The Grudge has done. So it got poor reviews, but that doesn't matter when it's money in the bank. And number 14 is Ashfall, the Korean disaster flick involving a volcano. $11 million it made this week. It's at net $60 million and counting. Just Mercy, the Jamie Foxx and Michael B. Jordan drama, that opened at $10 million along with Like a Boss, the comedy starring Tiffany Haddish. Those both opened up in North America, basically. Neither of them got any Oscar love. Jamie Foxx and Michael B. Jordan were certainly hoping to, but it hasn't happened for Just Mercy.
Well, that movie, I mean, that's an example of a movie that, you know, you can fly under the radar, but people have to actually know that you're being released.
It's not that good a movie.
And
it's not a good movie. That's not about the marketing campaign. It's just not that good a movie. They were hoping it didn't happen.
Well, speaking of things, hoping that you did what you just said, it didn't happen. Like a Boss, okay? So my daughter went to see this, my 14-year-old daughter, and mm-hmm. I was like, what? Why did you go see that? She said, oh my God, It was so bad. It was hilarious. I said, well, what was it? Was it hilarious or was it bad? She said, no, it was hilarious because it was so bad. I'm like, oh my God, you're 14 and you're hate watching.
She's hate watching. What a bad father you are. At number 17, do you think people hate listen to our podcast? Oh God. All right. At number 17 is Good News, the Hindi comedy about in vitro fertilization. Hilarity ensues. $9 million it made this week. That's at $40 million worldwide. Doolittle. Robert Downey Jr. has a new franchise. He thought Doolittle is, of course, Dr. Doolittle, the friend to animals everywhere. It cost $175 million to make. It's getting some bad buzz. It has opened up in, I think, one or two territories. It made $8 million on its opening week. I don't know how that translates, but they're not doing a strong marketing campaign in North America. So hopes are low for this film.
What are you
I'm
talking
afraid.
About? Every billboard in Los Angeles.
Well, maybe in LA, but.
And do you know why it's every billboard in Los Angeles?
No, I don't.
Where do the producers and the star live?
Right.
So they want to say, no, man, we really marketed it in Los Angeles. not everywhere else. But yeah, I mean, look, you're releasing the movie in January, which again is not necessarily a sign that your movie is bad.
No, not at all. Not at all.
But I mean, why not release this movie over Christmas?
Well, again, there's 12 months of the year. They have no competition. It's a good time to release a movie. He's a big star. It just doesn't sound like they made a very good one. At number 19 is Ford versus Ferrari. That got some Oscar love. It's up for Best Picture. However, it hasn't a chance in hell because it's not nominated for Best Director. And none of the actors got a nomination. Christian Bale and Matt Damon, both of whom I would have been rooting for to deserve a nomination, but they didn't do it.
And you know what Christian Bale is saying? I mean, how much weight can I lose, people? How much? I lost 70 pounds to play this role.
To play that role?
Yeah. Now, mind you, that said, the role that he played previously, he had gained a ton of weight for. It was Dick Cheney.
Oh, okay. So it's not that he got back healthy. That's all.
Yeah, pretty much.
He didn't lose weight for the role. That would be Joaquin Phoenix in Joker.
You know, Matt Damon asked him, he said, how did you lose so much weight? You know, and he expected to hear some like really,
elaborate.
Elaborate, intermittent fasting and, a celery diet or whatever. No, he said, I just did night.
Well, Ford versus Ferrari is at $210 million worldwide. It's coming out on Blu-ray and DVD, so it's going to be available digitally. Maybe it is now. Maybe it's already available for, on demand. I don't know. But it's going to not get a big bump from the Oscars, but it's in theater, so maybe it'll get something.
And it has a the stamp of recommendation from my 14-year-old daughter who I dragged to go see it, and she came out saying, hey, that movie was really good.
Yeah, no, I liked it. It's not on my best of the year list, but I thought it was a good, solid film, and it's certainly one you'll enjoy a lot more in a movie theater. Right below that is a Brazilian comedy, My Mom is a Character 3. Another $8 million that made. It's at $22 million. Guy Ritchie is chugging along with his new crime drama, The Gentleman. That made $7 million. It's at $14 million and counting. Now we have another Indian film. It's Sarileru Neikuvaru. I apologize for my pronunciation. That had an opening day of $7 million worldwide. It features a big rising star, Mahesh Babu, and it's a Telugu film. It's in the Telugu language. The Bollywood charts that I've been going to apparently do not include Tamil or Telugu films. It's only Hindi films, right?
You want to talk about a war going. I mean, maybe that's the wrong word. A battle going on for box office dominance.
They cater to different audiences.
Correct.
Films cross over all the time. They get remade. It's a great big beautiful world. Let's not make it ugly. They're making films in their own language that people are loving, and they cross over. This movie made $1.7 million in the U.S. over the weekend. And its opening is pegged to Maghi, a festival celebrating the Hindu sun god. That's true for another film called Darbar, which is not on the charts here, but that made some good money. It's not clear to me how much. It's a Tamil language film. It opened on January 9th to coincide with their festival, which they call Pongal, a multi-day harvest festival dedicated to the Hindu sun god. So everybody's got their own name for the festival. They all take place at roughly the same time. That's why you have a number of big movies opening up on the charts, including a film towards the bottom. It's called Chapaak or Chapaak. I'm not sure how to pronounce it.
That is literally the last film on our charts. $2 million, 30, It's the 32nd film on our charts.
That's right. But this is an Indian drama. It's about a woman, a true story of a woman who survived an acid attack. It's directed by a woman. It's produced by women. So it's a rare female-driven property. It cost $6 million to make, and it opened to $2 million. So hopefully they will be successful when all is said and done. And right up above there in the middle is Tanhaji, The Unsung Warrior. That's about a female warrior. That is another big Indian film. It opened to $5 million. I've seen a lot of trailers for that in the United States. So they gave a big push to that film. We'll have to see if it keeps going on. But yes, there's Hindi films, there's Telugu films, there's Tamil films. And if anybody knows a chart that will include all of them, not just their own language films, but all the films on the Indian continent and rank them all according to box office each weekend or week, let us know.
Yes, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're also on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox. And you can like our page on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. You know, Michael, you mentioned all of those films for different people.
Yeah, and
in
I forgot
countries.
Warriors of Horner, also an Indian film that made $6 million. Is that? No, that might be Chinese. That's the Chinese film. I beg your pardon. Keep going.
Well, you know, there are also films for animals. Cats, in fact.
That made about $2 million this week worldwide. It's been falling hard off the charts. If you want to hate watch that film, hey, is your daughter going to see that? Get going fast, because it's going to head to the discount theaters right now, and it'll be gone in the blink of an eye.
Yes, well, you know, when it heads to the discount theaters, it's not going to be doing next year's worldwide box office tally any good.
That's right. Though I would point out that Adam Sandler had a great weekend at the box office with Uncut Gems that made another $7 million. That's at $43 million. That is solely attributable to his star power. That's a real credit to him. But he did not have any luck from
right
the
now?
Oscars. What?
Take that, Amy Pascal.
So what is the worldwide box office? We cover a lot of worldwide charts and hits. We want to talk about them and what they are, like Servant. I don't know what that film is about. If you do, we just gave you the info. Let us know, because that's made $20 million and we have no idea what country it's from or what it's about.
And we have searched high and low.
Indeed. So what?
And we found a lot of films named Servant, just not the one we're looking for.
That's right. So what's the deal?
So the global box office in 2019, again, initial numbers, but still it's probably not going to deviate that much. $42.5 billion worldwide.
That's right. So that's a great story. It's a new record. The international box office set a record. It passed $30 billion for the first time. North America was down about 4%. China has slowed. It was galloping along. Now it just grew like, what, 5%? Something like that. So,
yes.
You know, those are slowing down. Those are more mature markets. But the worldwide box office still has a lot of room to grow, like in India and Africa. It's great to see those numbers. And movies are still hugely popular, despite all the competition and all the ways you can see movies without having to get out of your bed. And you know, we love movies and you want to honor them, and lots of nominations. The Visual Effects Society announced their nominees. They bizarrely, this is interesting, they have best visual effects and they have best supporting visual effects. So you have movies like Star Wars and Avengers, and then you have movies like Ford versus Ferrari. You don't think of the visual effects in those movies, but you know they're there. And the Irishman is in the supporting visual effects category, but frankly I would think that deserved to be in the best visual effects proper, because that's the entire movie.
Yeah, and I haven't seen the movie yet because I refuse to see it on the small screen.
But
just because I don't have 9 hours to set aside.
3 hours and 20 minutes. But I would tell the visual effects people, you do not alphabetize movies by the words "the," or every film will be listed under "the." The Irishman is "I." You know, that's what you do. You do not do it by "the." People, please. The WGA. I will let them put 1917 first, because that is a number, though personally I prefer to just spell it out and alphabetize that way. But they have their nominations for Best Original Screenplay and Adapted Screenplay, pretty much mirroring the Oscars. The DGA, that their nominees, those are the movies you would expect to be the biggest ones up for Best Picture and Director. Jojo Rabbit, Taiki, he did not get a Best Director nomination.
Taika Waititi did not get a nomination.
So everybody else got a nomination, right? Sam Mendes, Parasite, Once Upon a Time, Tarantino, and Scorsese.
Correct. And there are no women on the DGA list. Everybody thought, oh, there's going to be at least one woman, specifically Greta Gerwig, they thought.
Who else did they think was going to be up there?
Todd Phillips for The Joker.
What other woman?
Oh, Lulu Wang from The Farewell.
Ah, which got zero love from the Oscars.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, that deserved at least writing.
Well, I wouldn't say so, but it certainly it had fans and was a big hit and people liked it. So sure, Awkwafina won a Golden Globe and couldn't even get a nomination. But those are the DGA. They have Best Doc, Producers Guild. They have their list of the 10 best films. I think it's pretty much a lock, a match, except for Knives Out. There are 9 films on the Best Picture list, and I think the Producers Guild nailed them all.
Well, okay, so those two lists, the Best Picture Producers Guild Award and Best Picture Oscar category,
I think they're
are always really close to being in lockstep. However, lately, the Producers Guild has had about 9 or 10 different nominees, and the Oscars has had only 8 or 9.
And this year, well, they usually have 8 or 9. This year, they have 9.
Yeah, and so one usually has to drop out. One or two usually have to drop out. And so I said before the awards were, you know, the Oscar nominations were handed out, I wrote, more than likely, one or two of these will have to drop out. Which ones do you think they'll be?
Well, of course, because there's 10, and there's barely 10.
And so which one, so would you have picked Knives Out?
Oh, I think so, yeah.
Yeah, same here.
Yeah, it might have been Jojo Rabbit, but I think Knives Out was really the longest shot of all those movies. So that brings us to the Oscars, right? We've got Oscar nominations. Let's repeat the things that everybody else has said.
Okay. Hey, The Irishman has a lot of nominations.
So does The Joker.
So does what other movies? 1917, yes. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
But Quentin Tarantino, the enfant terrible, will he beat out Scorsese and win Best Director?
Well, he's going to say, if he does, he's going to get up there and say, you know, as the director, I make all the decisions. And so really, I've got nobody to thank but
myself.
That's
a screenwriting joke. It's perfectly valid. But I know the biggest studio on the planet isn't Warner Brothers. It isn't Disney. It isn't Sony. It isn't Paramount.
It's Netflix.
It's Netflix. They got nominated for twice for Best Picture and twice for Best Documentary. The Irishman, Marriage Story, American Factory, and The Edge of Democracy are all nominated for the best films of the year in their respective categories. Good for them. They're making a lot of really good movies. You can yell and scream about them. I understand that if you're an exhibitor, but they're making quality films.
Yeah, well, and they're making the kinds of films that get nominated. Okay, let's face it. I mean, Avengers Endgame is not the kind of film that ever got nominations, even in years when On Golden Pond was being
made.
Well,
but they, what's wrong with On Golden Pond?
I just picked a film out of a hat. Literally the first film that came to mind.
Why don't you name a bad movie? Like, you know, Around the World in 80 Days or something.
Well, no, what I mean is when studios were making the kinds of films on a regular basis that were kind of adult fare or the kinds
right,
of...
Right, well, but, you know, Joker got nominated this year. So when you're correct. Saying cartoon movies don't get nominated, they did. They got the most nominations of any film. And so did the husband and wife team. Has this ever happened before? Absolutely not. Greta Gerwig and Noah Baumbach both directed films that are nominated for Best Picture. They both got a nomination for Best Screenplay, one for adapted, one for original. That's very cool. And in fact, 62 women got nominations this year, the most ever, but not Greta or Noah. So thank God he didn't get nominated for Best Director. It would have been an ugly night at the house.
Yeah, could you imagine that dinner table? Like,
I'm sure they would have been supportive.
Congratulations, dear. I hope you win.
I'm so happy for you. I'm sure they would have been excited to support each other. And everybody's excited for Emma Tillinger-Koskoff. She's the second woman to have 2 Best Picture nominees in the same year. Megan Ellison did that trick once before. Very few people, period, ever do that, much less women. So that's great. And Koskoff's 2 films are The Irishman and Joker. So I don't know. She hopes she doesn't cancel herself out, because those are both, you know, front runners for sure for Best Picture.
Who does she sit with at the Oscars? That's the question. She's going to have to literally sit like, no, guys, I'm going to sit in the middle. You guys sit on opposite ends.
And in other good news for women, Hildur Guðnadóttir, I think that's how you say her name. She did Chernobyl. Great score for that TV movie. She just won an Emmy, I believe. And she's up for Joker. That's probably the best element of the film is her score.
Really? Yeah. I'm scrolling down in our notes to best.
We obviously know there aren't a lot of people of color. Cynthia Erivo got nominated for Harriet. Antonio Banderas is a person who is Spanish is a person of color.
Yes, I suppose.
I've just been told no by one person. I argue no. They're hysterical.
What, do you have an audience? Hispanic. You have an audience? I don't get an audience. You got an audience? Unbelievable. Yeah,
certainly people, Latino and Hispanic people face prejudice and discrimination, but they get grouped more and more under white/Hispanic. It's sort of like the Irish and the Italians where white people said, oh, they're not really white. And then like, yeah, they're white. They're not like those people. So it's always a changing standard of what counts as a white person or person of color. But I would say there are two people who broke down barriers for minorities. That would be Cynthia Erivo and Antonio Banderas in the acting categories. They're the only two people of any minorities that are in that mix this year. So not a good year for representation. I assume there are more people in producing and credits and documentaries and shorts and stuff like that. But as far as the big categories, that's it. We also have, of course, Korean director and best picture. So that's great to see.
Well, true. And I'm just glad that when it came to nominating people for original score that, you know, John Williams, long overlooked, he wasn't overlooked for Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker. Are you kidding me? The guy wrote this music like 50 years ago and you're nominating it now.
Yeah, he's gotten 52 nominations. Only Walt Disney had more. He had 59. And you know what? John Williams actually worked for all those 52 nominations. Sometimes Walt just had his name on it. Let's be honest. He might have greenlit it, but he wasn't working hard. John Williams wrote all those scores. So that is amazing. He's won 5 times, Fiddler on the Roof, Jaws, Star Wars, E.T., Schindler's List. He will not win this year.
No, he will not win.
De Niro or J-Lo or Awkwafina or a bunch of other people who are snubbed. Snubbed, I say. No, they weren't. They weren't snubbed. Nobody deserves an Oscar nomination.
Yeah, and I did not think that Jennifer Lopez was going to be nominated. I just did not think that was
going to be the case. Well, she'd gotten nominations by other people, so it wouldn't have been shocking, but I just didn't think the film was that good. But I don't think most of the films nominated for Best Picture are good. But I was excited by the animated film category. Three of the five movies are international films. The French film, I Lost My Body. Klaus, which is it German?
By the way, I Lost My Body, I believe, also a Netflix movie.
Yes. Oh, is it?
Yes.
Oh, so
I
that's
so.
Six films. You're right. Well, they picked it up. I don't think that they originally made it. I feel
No, that is correct.
Right.
They picked it up.
Well, I mean, full credit for picking it up, but they actually made those other movies. They made The Irishman. They made Marriage Story happen. They made the two docs happen, I believe. Maybe they came in later in the game, but I believe they funded them from the get-go. I Lost My Body played at Cannes. I'm excited to see it. I still haven't. Klaus. And then Missing Link, the British film. So three of the five nominees are showing real independence there. They did not, you know, knee-jerk nominate Frozen 2 or some other Hollywood junk. They just gave it to Toy Story 4, which is good, not great. And How I Trained My Dragon, How to Train Your Dragon, The Hidden World, or whatever the final film was called.
Yeah, I was going to say, you have a dragon?
I wish I had a dragon. And other fun news in documentaries and best international film. We assume the best international film winner will be Parasite. However, Honeyland, the documentary, one of the rare films to be nominated in multiple categories. There should be a doc up for Best Picture. Should have happened long ago. It could have happened this year with this movie, but it did get nominated for Best Documentary and also Best International Film. The last time a doc got nominated in this category was, I think, 2008 with the animated documentary Waltz with Bashir, which was a very good film.
Yeah. Now, who has been raving about this movie for months now?
Sperling.
That's right. It was the film that I was like, oh, I don't know. Despite being an amateur beekeeper, I don't want to go see this movie. It doesn't sound. And I didn't see it at Sundance. And then I saw it after Sundance. It was like, oh, my God, what? I missed it. This is an amazing movie. And I think it deserves to win the documentary category. I know, you know, there are other favorites like American Factory or whatever.
I don't think there's any lock. And given its nomination in two categories, I think that will make people watch it and say, oh, I want to got to check that out. It's moving. It's gorgeously shot. It could have been nominated for Best Cinematography. It wasn't. I think that wild card slot went to The Lighthouse, the black and white film starring Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe. But it could have been nominated there, frankly. So that's a great strength, though. Two big categories. I think that gives it a leg up. I wouldn't be surprised if it won. But, you know, it's
and frankly, to be perfectly honest, if you look at that film, and I'm talking about Honeyland, when you think about how hard it was to make that movie over the course of 3 years in like the hinterlands, it's a feat.
Yeah. So, you know, people will read the tea leaves and they will talk about who's got the edge here or there, who didn't get a nomination, like Taron Egerton. I bet Bombshell wins makeup right away, makeup and hair. It's got to be Bombshell.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Especially since I literally thought Megyn Kelly had made a movie.
Yeah. No, people talk about two nominations for acting. That movie is sort of faded away. But there are no other locks, I don't think, in a lot of categories. Maybe people think Renee Zellweger is the front runner, but I don't think there's any clear winners in any categories. But who do you think will win Best Picture? That's the only one that matters. Will it be a foreign language film? Will it be Parasite for the first time in history? Or will it be Joker? It's got the most nominations. Or will it be Scorsese's Swan Song? People love that movie too. Or will
you think this is the last movie he's ever going to make?
Well, it's not. You can't assume he's going to make movies that are going to be. He said it might be. He's in his 80s or whatever, and you know, you don't often make
maybe
movies.
Maybe he was just talking fast. Maybe he just said, "This is my last movie. This is my last movie. It's the last movie that I made
this week."
This week, yeah. It's just, I talk really fast, so maybe you think I said it was the last movie, but it was really just the last movie that I made, and I'm making the next movie next time.
Or will it be The Ode to Hollywood that Quentin Tarantino delivered? Or will it be 1917 because it's in the theaters making money and they love period war films? Talk to me, baby.
I think...
And let's narrow it down to the ones that are nominated for Best Director, because it's not going to be anybody else. So we'll narrow it down to The Irishman, Joker, 1917, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, or Parasite.
I would be shocked if it's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Why? Reviews. I didn't love it, but it got great reviews. It's a movie about Hollywood. It's Quentin Tarantino, who's been nominated many times, and he's won Best Director, hasn't he? Yeah. So why would it be shocking? So you're going to write that off the list right away. What next?
I really like Parasite and 1917. I just don't think the Academy is willing to give a film that was made by Netflix, despite the fact that it's a feat and it's 3.5 hours long.
They gave
them
nothing but nominations. Why would you think they nominate it for Best Picture but be refusing to actually give it Best Picture? It doesn't make any sense that the same people who said, we love Marriage Story, we love Parasite,
I always forget this whole preferential balloting. People might do this, okay? So just hear me out here. I think what they'll do is, you know what? Yeah, blah, blah, blah. Just like my theory with they can't give it number one, okay?
But everybody might make it number two.
Everybody will make it number two. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and Parasite will and 1917 will split the top vote. Meanwhile, The Irishman just squeaks by at number two, with actually taking Best Picture.
So that's your pick.
And only because of the weird...
Well, it got 10 nominations. It's not like people don't like it. It's one of their favorite films of the year. But true. They didn't give De Niro a Best Actor nomination. Why would that be if they think it's the best film of the year?
Yeah, that's true. So actually, I think it's between Parasite and 1917. I don't think Joker, I don't think it can win.
You think it's just going to win Best Actor and that's it?
Yes, I think that it will win Best Actor because, you know, Joaquin, has he won before?
No.
No, so I think this is his year for that. And that will be its prize. Like, congratulations, you've won, you know, best actor. It's between Parasite and 1917. Or maybe I'm overestimating 1917. I don't know.
It's 10 nominations. I'm just making sure he has never won an Oscar.
Okay.
He's got a lot of nominations, a lot of awards, but he's been nominated four times for Gladiator, Walk the Line, The Master, and now Joker.
So
he has never won.
He's never won.
Well,
so.
You know, it's not like he's 90.
No, but look, like if he was a baseball player, right? Mm-hmm. This would technically be, you know, you batting 300. This would be his time.
I think it's a crapshoot. There's no way to say this is going to win. There's an argument to be made for any of them. I don't see any clear front runner at all, as proven by the fact that there are four films with 10 and 11. That's a lot of nominations for four different movies. It's a horse race, and it's going to come down to a squeaky vote. I'd love to see the tallies. I wish they'd say, you know what, it's 50 years later, let's release the vote totals for the movies that won best, 50 years ago. Let's find out.
You know
out.
What? Actually, I condone that, I guess, I would back you up on that, and here's why.
It's fun.
I think it's fun, number one. Number two, it actually helps revive interest in movies that people may have long forgotten about or not even know about.
Absolutely. And it's so a great thing to do during Oscar season. You know, maybe one week you do the movies from 80 years ago, and then the next week 70, then 60, then 50, and then you stop there, and you do that every year. You know, the what one 80 years ago or 90, well, how many years are there?
Well, 92, right, to be exact.
So, yeah, so there, you know, there won't even be totals perhaps for the earliest ones, but, you know, why not? It's, you know, no one's going to care. Like, they're not going to be angry that 50 years later you reveal that I, you know, one guy won in a sweep or one gal won by two votes. You know, it'll be fun.
I love the fact that Tom Hanks is nominated again. He's like, well, I did show up for a film, so you gotta, it's law. It's law. It's Hollywood law.
Oh, leave him on Meryl Streep alone. She didn't get a nomination for Little Women.
Yes, but, you know, and Brad Pitt, do you think Brad Pitt has a hope here with supporting actor?
I think he'll win. I don't think he has a hope. I think he's as close to a lock as there is. They like him a lot. He's been in a lot of movies. They clearly like the film. He's got the most appealing role in the movie. He's a big movie star. He's proven his chops and his dedication to try and make smaller movies. I think there, you know, he produces stuff, you know, I think he's got everything going for him. I think the two guys, you know, but of course I don't like The Irishman, so that cancels it out. I think Tom Hanks is too obvious for A Beautiful Day, and the Pope, you know, the Pope could win, but yeah, he just seems to be the one that's his year.
Well, and you know, Joe Pesci also nominated. He's just glad that nobody under the age of 50 was nominated in his category, because he doesn't want to have to go against the Utes. You know what I mean?
And you look at Best Picture, most of the nine films.
Dude, I threw in a My Cousin Vinny joke. You didn't even like acknowledge.
Never saw it.
Oh my God. People who saw it said Utes. And you have to go watch My Cousin Vinny, and you'll understand the joke.
Oh, yeah, I've heard that line before, Utes, but there you go. So of the films nominated for Best Picture, only Joker is based on a comic book, of course, and Little Women is based on a pre-existing story. Everything else is mostly, you know, they're based on The Irishman, on an obscure nonfiction book. Ford versus Ferrari may have had some source material, but these are fairly original things here. Ford versus Ferrari, The Irishman, Jojo Rabbit, Marriage Story, 1917, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and Parasite. These are the films that get nominated and win Best Picture. Original ideas, not sequels and prequels and franchises. But the franchises keep coming, don't they?
Well, I guess it depends on, you know, really what you're referring to. Because if you're talking about maybe...
Clarice.
Yes. Are the lambs still screaming, Clarice? Speaking of Anthony Hopkins, who was nominated... Well, here's the deal. So this movie was a huge movie. Jonathan Demme.
The Silence of the Lambs.
Silence of the Lambs. Huge book, huge movie.
The first horror film to win Best Picture, or thriller, however you want to classify it.
And they said about 90 years later, hey, you know what we should do? A total spinoff. Let's turn it into a TV show.
Well, they did Hannibal. That was the TV show that people really loved.
Right. Yeah. You're right. I take it all back. You're right. So now they're saying, well, we did one about the killer. Let's do one about the detective.
Right. And it takes place right after the film. And so you're just following the rest of the career of Clarice in her job. So it's a slam dunk in terms of her. It's
a TV show. It's a TV series.
They're just using the idea of the movie as a way to launch a new show. It's not like it's wildly based on the film or whatever. But, you know, yeah, it's a great character. It was a great role for Jodie Foster. We'll have to see what happens. But it shows the networks and a lack of originality that's coming from CBS, and it can join along with Chucky, the TV series, revivals of Lassie, Mr. Magoo, George of the Jungle. That's on the CBS To Go thing. I mean, you know, it's like they never have.
Well,
an original
that's why
idea.
And you said, hey, there's no more pilot season. Why make a pilot? You're going to need the content anyway. If the show is horrible, at least you'll get six episodes out of it. That's six more things you can throw on your streaming service that weren't there before.
And yet sometimes they announce adapting something in a new format, and I'm excited, like The Nanny. The Nanny is a sitcom that my friend Zoe loves. She's crazy about the show. She owns the entire box set on DVD. She can sing the song at the drop of a hat. And now they're turning it into a Broadway musical. Fran Drescher is involved. She's co-writing the book. And this is the cool part. Rachel Bloom of My Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, or I should say Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, and Adam Schlesinger of Fountains of Wayne, they did all those songs for that show, which were a lot of them really great. They are doing the songs and score. So it's the Nanny the musical coming to Broadway someday. They're very early stages, but everybody's involved. And that, to me, I'm excited to see.
I have to say, I love Rachel Bloom, so I'm kind of excited to see it too. And Adam Schlesinger, Fountains of Wayne, the
great
rock
power group. Pop band, yeah.
Yeah, but the only band I know of named after a home improvement store.
Fountains of Wayne is a home improvement store?
Yes, they were trying to name their band, and they were in Wayne, New Jersey, and they went past a store that sold, you know, water fountains, like water features for your backyard or your house, and it said Fountains of Wayne, and they said, but that's the name of the band.
Well, you know, and I like Fran Drescher a lot. She's sort of one of those people who are inherently funny. She can just say good morning or hello, and you're already laughing, because she's got a great voice. She's a great personality, and she said, I could do it on Broadway, but then we'd have to change the name to The Granny.
She's like in her 50s. Yeah, that's
right. Exactly. She's not old at all. But yeah, she's not going to be starring in the show. They will be finding a new talent to play the nanny. But that's going to be fun. I think it's a big deal because, you know, we've been talking about Rachel Bloom. She's got she had a great series with a great Broadway DNA in it. And we're like, will they bring Crazy Ex-Girlfriend to Broadway? Will she do some other project? Now we have our answer.
The answer is she's going to Broadway, just not with Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Or she might have a Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, but that said, she's actually not going to play Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
I gave you a layup.
If you think that's a big deal,
yeah.
Okay, I wonder what you think about some of these stories in Big Deal or Big Whoop this week. Big Deal or Big Whoop is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, shocking the entire industry. This was huge news, huge. The hit musical Hamilton has ended its run.
What?
In Chicago.
Oh.
Yes, the smash hit Tuner is still on Broadway and in London and elsewhere around the world, but a sit-down production in Chicago has called it a day after 3 years in the Windy City and some... Sit down, Michael. Sit down. $400 million in Chicago. Okay,
wow.
It made $400 million in grosses in Chicago alone, and it lasted 3 years. If it ran 3 years on Broadway, it would have been one of the longest running hits in theater history. And by the way, it did it in Chicago. Actor Miguel Cervantes played the lead role throughout the entire run. But he's not done yet. Cervantes will still be doing it in Chicago, despite the fact that no tickets are being sold. Okay, he just can't give up the role.
No.
Oh, wait, I'm sorry, I misread this. He'll be taking over the role on Broadway in a few months. We're pretty sure it will still be there waiting for him. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. It shows what a big hit this is, and it's not the longest running hit like this in Chicago history. Wicked ran for 3 years and 3 months, or 3 months longer than whatever the actual exact total was for Hamilton. That's just amazing. But it made more money than anybody else because of when it hit town and how premium pricing has taken over all over the, you know, North America. But that's just shocking. And you know what? I saw on trailer, I went to see Little Women over the weekend. I thought the screenplay and structure was by far the best thing about it. I liked it. I didn't love it.
But were the women really tiny? I mean,
no.
Okay.
I thought it was interesting. But before the movie began was the trailer again for In the Heights. My mom saw and said, oh, that looks interesting.
That movie, in my opinion,
it's going to be big.
It's going to be huge.
Yeah,
it's going to make a mountain of money.
Relatively speaking, yeah. I think it's well poised to be one of those rare original, you know, I mean, a movie musical that's going to do really well. I think it will. I think it's perfectly timed. You know, it's just got everything going for it. And it's a very appealing trailer.
Yes, I agree. Now, here's the thing. This next story, I heard about all week. And by the end, I was like, please, I don't want to hear anymore. And then I looked
You heard about it all week?
And here it is in our show notes. Because if you make movies, okay, you really, we talked about it, you want an Oscar, okay? We want an Oscar and we don't make movies, okay? So that tells you how much people want an Oscar. But if you make music, well, you want a Grammy.
Or best podcast, right? We want that too.
Yeah. Give us one of those.
And if Cynthia Erivo wins, she will be an EGOT, by the way.
That's true.
Emmy, Grammy, Tony for The Color Purple related products, and now an Oscar, perhaps, for Harriet.
Well, Michael, if you write romance novels, which I do, by the way, nobody reads them, but I write them. If you do write romance novels, you want a Rita. Yes, the Rita Awards, that's RITA, the Rita Awards are the most prestigious writing award for bodice rippers. And by the way, Don't call romance novels bodice rippers, okay? Like every other genre, including literary fiction, romance novels range in quality and style and setting from historical romances to modern rom-coms and the like. And like every other art form, especially ones that make your loins quiver, get it? See what I did there? Mm-hmm. Yeah, they have their controversies. This year, it revolves around racial stereotypes. The readers have been rocked not by an author's perceived racial insensitivity, but by an author who criticized the racial sensitivity of others. Romance novels have often been segregated by race in bookstores, with some wrongly assuming no one would want to read a romance novel about anyone other than white women. Many novels trafficked in stereotypes others found offensive, yet the biggest discipline ever taken by the readers was not over a racist novel or author. It was over writer Courtney Milan calling out the racism in a book she had spotted. Milan is known for her activism and once served as the chair of the ethics committee. She was actually given an award for that just like recently, like within the past year. Milan said on her personal Twitter account that a certain book contained offensive stereotypes. For that, Milan was suspended and banned for life from any leadership position in the organization. And that created a firestorm. Board members quit, the head of the readers stepped down, and now the annual awards have been canceled while the organization regroups and figures out what to do next. So, Michael, you're heavy into the publishing industry. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It is a big deal. It's a shame that the whole conference and thing is falling apart a bit. It's an important group. It represents a lot of writers that they don't get attention anywhere else. But, you know, the romance genre and world has had a long history of problematic content and material, and they're grappling with it. And to finally take a stance and do something, but to be telling someone, shut up, don't talk about that, that's really not a good look. So
yeah, I agree.
That was really, you know, whatever you think about Rita's comment,
Milan's comments.
Milan's comments and the context of it and the fact that she hadn't read the entire book. She's like, well, that's me. They're talking about me. I know this, you know. So, whatever. The fact is, this is the worst possible way to bring this out into the light and really start to tackle it, but maybe some good will come out of it. And I can't believe you've been hearing about it all week. This seems
It was on NPR. It was evening news. Oh, yeah.
Well, that's great. Well, good. So, yeah, romance writers deserve more attention. They just wish it wasn't this.
Well, the head of the FX network, John Landgraf, we talk about him all the time, really. He's done counting, okay? He's reached infinity.
Three. Yeah, and beyond.
He says, enough already. Landgraf dubbed the mayor of TV for his annual State of the Union address during the Winter Television Critics Association press tour. That's that press tour you referenced earlier, Michael.
The TCAs.
Yes, he said the number of scripted TV shows hit a record 532 in all during 2019. But with the streaming wars picking up pace, Landgraf says that number is going to grow even more in 2020. And this was the guy that back in 2015 coined the word peak TV, okay? Mm-hmm. And that's when he started counting. And he's, by the way, not a Sesame Street character like Count Von Count, okay?
Remember that guy? One Sesame, two Sesame.
Right, yeah. So he's calling it a day. He's like, I'm done counting. I thought it was peak TV back in 2015. I coined the phrase, and then I proved myself wrong. He's not done on pontificating, by the way, just on tallying up all these shows. Critics can't keep up, and now no longer can Landgraf. He does note one interesting fact. Basic cable is getting out of the scripted game. Many channels are sticking to cheaper reality shows or seeing their original content migrate to a paid streaming service. FX's shows, of course, will be available on Hulu, so I guess there's that. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. He's not counting anymore. There's more shows than he can keep up with. Welcome to the world we all live in. I have a list of 50 really good recent shows I need to watch, like Sex Education and a million others. It's exhausting. But ABC said at the TCAs, this was interesting, they really want to de-emphasize pilot season. I think we've already seen the end of pilot season. It used to be once a year, there'd be this big mad rush. You'd want to sign up whatever stars were available to get them in your pilots, and you'd film it, and then you'd decide what shows to make, and it would be this big frenzy for a few weeks or months. That's over with. People make shows all the time now. They greenlight them all the time. They air them 365 days a year. There's no fall TV season anymore. Big shows open up, like you say, January, March, August, September, June, July. You know, there's no rhyme or reason to it anymore. Pilot season will still be helpful, a little extra attention where you focus. The fall launch will still be helpful to bring a little attention, but TV is 365 days a year, and that's just the world we live in. Especially if you want to watch all those 532 shows, you got to watch two shows a day.
Well, and the reality is this, you know, we used to be able to count on John Landgraf counting, and now we can't count on John Landgraf counting.
Well, we could count, but we'd get exhausted. That's true. Let's just count on ebooks.
That's true. We could count ebooks. Libraries are loaning out ebooks at a record pace. Actually, we're not certain of that, but we think that that's true. In 2019, more than 326 million ebooks were borrowed from libraries around the world.
I should say major libraries, because we don't have, you know, yeah.
Yeah. Well, obviously, we don't have data from every library system, as you just mentioned, Michael, but the ones that do provide figures say ebooks are increasingly popular. In fact, 73 public library systems here in the United States in just 73 public library systems in just 5 countries.
Yeah.
Each loaned at least 1 million ebooks in the last calendar year. That's 5 million ebooks. Toronto topped the list with 6.6 million ebooks.
Woohoo!
Circulating. Yeah. LA was the top system in the US. That's my library system. 5.9 million copies they loaned out over the internet. And Singapore was the biggest ebook lender outside North America with 4.2 million loans. And the best part? There wasn't a single late fee. In fact, I think the LA Public Library has done away with their late fees. So,
yeah, like I said, yeah, keep going.
Is it a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I'll tell you, it's a big deal. We talk about, ebooks have faded. They're not in. Well, you know, A, they raised prices a lot on ebooks, made them more expensive than hardcover or paperback, which is bonkers. So, yes, of course, they managed to strangle the ebook in its crib. Plus, of course, people stopped buying Kindles and e-readers because they were getting bigger and bigger smartphones. And now they read more on their phones. But that's not as useful for a book as opposed to some quick little thing. But people still buy a lot of ebooks. New bestsellers tend to be dominated by ebook. That's the format that they use the most. And if you add in libraries and all the attention there and all the books that get borrowed there, I think ebooks are still massively popular, massively important. So publishers need to respect that and know that, work with libraries, make that happen. And yes, like you say, late fees are increasing as a movement, getting rid of them. They're just saying, yeah, you know what? That doesn't help anybody. It keeps people from using the library. If you have books that are checked out, you just need to bring them back in. We're not going to charge you a fee. They're not saying you can do whatever you want. They're just saying if you've checked books out, bring them back in. You know, we're not going to charge you a fee. We just want you to bring them back in. Then you can keep borrowing other books. But people realize they have a late fee. It's too much. They just stop using the system. And of course, it's poor people who suffer the most from this. And that's one good thing about ebooks. There's no late fees. But yes, late fees are disappearing all over the country. It's a really smart movement. It keeps people who can use the library and encourages them to use it and recognizes sometimes people are late. That's okay. Just bring it back.
Well, Warner Brothers has hired a new top executive, John Landgraf. No, I'm kidding.
Michael Giltz.
Their name, by the way, IBM's Watson.
Oh,
okay. Not literally IBM's Watson. He's already got a job. What is Jeopardy? But Warner Brothers has signed up an artificial intelligent film management system to offer up advice when deciding whether to greenlight a film. The company is called Synalytic. And they use machine learning to predict a film's success. You know, past movies with female stars aged 30 to 35 and including cute puppies have grossed an average of $42 million at the North American box office. So this movie with a female star aged 32 and 6 cute puppies should gross $42 million and a 7th cute puppy will not make it earn any more. Mostly, it's intended as a tool to help in deciding release dates and marketing decisions, but still, robots are coming to take your jobs, people, especially in Hollywood. Just as long as they don't create an AI to do podcasts, we'll be fine, Michael. And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Too late. There will be a podcast done by... All right. This is a big whoop. It's just some companies put out a press release that got good attention. They're using it as a tool. Who knows how helpful it will be? We'll have to see. From what I've ever seen, not a lot. Hey, July 4th is a great time to release a movie. Or this movie,
This is the kind of thing that basically it's like, okay, so you're using a computer to do what computers do, meaning you're putting all of the variables into a computer, like, okay, Scarlett Johansson, makes X amount of money every time she stars in a film when it's this genre. You know, you're basically turning it into a calculator And instead of it taking days to do these formulas, it does it in minutes. Okay, right. Great. We don't need artificial intelligence to tell me that Scarlett Johansson is kind of a big deal.
Right. And machine learning works great. It's very powerful. It can do things we can't do a lot faster. But typically, you're not going to have the programmer system or the brain power, meaning, you know, data power, to do things beyond what people could do when you're talking about something like this. Not to critique Synalytic. Maybe they'll blow our minds away. If you want to give us a demo, you know, come on over. But in general, you're not dealing with enough machine learning with enough data to really make a difference, because there's only, you know, 1,000 movies a year. There just aren't that many movies with these genre, you know, dogs sell, you know, it just doesn't work very well from what we've ever seen. Someday maybe we could be surprised, but right now it seems mostly not ready for prime time. But the TCAs are still going on. Shameless renewed for its 11th and final season. And in case you're excited by The Nanny, the musical, what about, you know, The Vacation, the musical? So the Griswolds are coming to Broadway. Broadway Vacation is a musical that's going to open in Seattle in the fall of 2020. Good Lord.
Yeah, how are they going to get the roller coaster in the...
Good point.
Yeah, I mean, now if you don't know what I'm referring to, please see...
They understand. Vacation. They understand, okay, understand that if you make a reference and they don't get it, they should go check it out.
Well, you know, they did take that roller coaster down. The real roller coaster that they used in the movie, they mm-hmm. took it down recently. Maybe they can just move it over to Broadway.
Well, I've seen many roller coasters on Broadway, many car rides. What happens is the actors pretend it's okay. They'll figure it out.
Okay, well, streaming music continues to grow and reshape the music industry. In the U.S., music hit 1 trillion streams for the first time
Woo-hoo!
Ever. Unbelievable. Sales, whether digital or physical, are falling across the board. Sales of singles are falling, with Old Town Road by Lil Nas X the only one to sell more than 1 million copies. Album sales are also down, with total sales falling to 93 million in all. And much of that came via bundling with concert tickets. So Taylor Swift, yeah, she was the only one to sell more than 1 million physical albums, just 1.1 million to be exact. And the resurgent vinyl format, what about that? Well, total sales of new albums topped just 10 million units. So back to the good news. Streaming represents 82% of all music consumption in the U.S., and while the growth is slowing and some revenue is slowing too, it's still a revolutionary and permanent change until the next revolutionary and permanent change comes along. And music business worldwide sees a dark cloud on the horizon. They say fewer and fewer superstars are gaining blockbuster attention, and that the streaming of being, you know, everything is being split up into smaller and smaller audience. That's the problem. It's the atomization of music. Honey, I shrunk your career. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal. I don't think it's a big deal that blockbuster artists are getting, you know, 500 billion million streams rather than 800 million streams like Drake 1 year compared to Post Malone this year. So what? Who cares? People are still getting a lot of attention. I think the more diversity is great, but it does make it harder for everyone to have that sort of cultural impact and that sort of cultural everybody sharing, like Thriller or Purple Rain or Adele 25. You know, it's harder and harder to have movies and TV shows and books and music that capture the world's attention when there's so many options out there and everybody's, you know, getting distracted by the latest bauble. So that's something that can be harder down the road, but if it means more money being spread out among more artists, that may be good for the artists and maybe bad for the labels who prefer to have, you know, 5 albums that sell 20 million copies. That's easy for them. It's harder when you got to say, hey, we need a stable of artists who have a good fan base, who tour and have long careers. That's better for the art form. And that's better for us, I think, overall.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much that could be said about what you just highlighted there.
It could have been an inside baseball. And by the way, I do really like music business worldwide. I get a lot of interesting insight from that website. You should check them out. But it is time for Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Both of these, I feel like, oh, well, the first one I think is for you. The second one is for me, Sperling. The first one is about filmmaker mode. It could make TV settings easier on televisions from LG and Samsung and Vizio. It involves an alliance. You love these groups. You stand on panels and group committees to set standards. It's the UHD Alliance, a group of TV manufacturers, Hollywood studios, and tech companies. They want to make it easier for you to watch TV shows and movies the way the creators intended. My only shock is that you were not on this committee.
Well, no, I, you know, I'm not on that committee, the UHD Alliance, but I can tell you it is on almost every committee that I do participate in. This issue is
what's
is
the
raised.
Issue? What is the issue?
The issue is films are shot at 24 frames per second. Okay, so for the most part, except for high frame rate, we you know
right, right,
and
right.
when
right, right, right. and most TV price. Shows now are shot 24 frames per second.
Yeah, 24, yeah, thereabouts. However, televisions out of the box were set at 120 hertz, 60 to 120 hertz. Okay, what that means is that's 60 to 120 frames per second.
Why so were they? Why were they different?
Smooth motion. Well, for really because people were buying TVs and then. Taking them home to watch football, and that's really why they were doing it. It makes things look a little crisper, especially when there's a lot of heavy motion, like in sports. And so part of the problem is that when you then take a film like, let's say, Joker, okay, you're then interpolating. You have to create frames. You have to create, like, you know, 5-6 frames around each frame.
It just
that
doesn't
exists.
Seem that hard for a television set to know I am now showing live sports. Everything's got code. You know that you're showing a
well,
sitcom.
That's the thing.
You've got a live sports or you've got a movie. And it would seem to me, or we're showing CNN, and it would seem pretty simple that it would recognize the format or type and adjust accordingly.
Yes, however, and I'm about to simplify this.
Okay, please.
So you used CNN as an example. Okay, so the metadata says, hey, it's news-related in English. But in French, it says presse. You know, so that sounded
well,
Italian.
I assume it's
why.
A code, meaning 4.257. It's not that it's a word.
Or it's metadata that
right.
says, you know, yeah. So that said, yes, that's what they're coming up with. Is that metadata? And here's why this is news, which, by the way, occurred at CES, the Consumer Electronics Show, in Las Vegas last week. The reason this is news is because though this was announced last year, and though filmmakers from Christopher Nolan to J.J. Abrams to James Cameron, you name the filmmaker, and they have wanted this on televisions for a long
right.
time.
They want their movies to be seen in the best possible way. Yeah.
Right. So the metadata and defining that metadata, really simple. You just define it. It becomes a standard. There you go. But now electronics manufacturers are saying, guess what? We're going to create TVs that listen for that metadata and actually automatically switch over. It won't make you, it won't force you to go into your settings.
No,
and do it
no,
manually.
That's not, wasn't expected. Of course, I'm expecting the TV to do it. Of course. Yes, that's the whole point. You're not supposed to have to get up and change the settings. That's ridiculous. That's the whole problem they're fixing.
Well, however, in some instances, the manufacturers are saying, well, We're going to allow you to have a button on the remote that turns it into filmmaker mode.
Well, they're idiots then. They're
well,
idiots. They're idiots.
They're trying to take a baby step.
Who needs a baby step? Why would anybody want to have to press a button when it could be done automatically for them? What moron thinks that's a better decision?
Well, and this is, you know, broadcast, by the way, is easy to fix because you just put broadcast flags up. What really needs to happen is for streamers to also adopt this. So the Netflix
well, why wouldn't
is
they?
Below. You know, I don't see any problem
right.
in them
but
adopting
idiot,
this. I think they
what,
haven't announced
what
it yet.
Idiot
I
thinks it's better to have a button and force you to press it every time you want to watch programming that might be better in that format that you wouldn't know. Because Game of Thrones isn't a film, but that might be better in filmmaker mode. Are you going to flash on the screen and say, if you want filmmaker mode, put it, just change it. That's stupid.
Well,
there's
I think they
no
just...
Shit. That's stupid.
Well, speaking of stupid things, I know you believe this next story
oh my God.
Is,
you think
is
that's
stupid. You know what? I think
you have business with these people and you can't say it because you can just say that.
No. I just think, you know, who cares? It's like you could either.
No, I care because I don't want to press
a button. You know what you could even have?
That's slightly better than having to change the settings, but that's still stupid.
I think you could even have a setting that says change it automatically for me or no, always make
it
manual.
And that would be the default. Changing automatically when your TV comes out of the box. Who the hell would want to change the
well,
set?
Well, that's what all the filmmakers want, by the way.
Something that would be worse than what the way it should be. Who in God's green earth would say, well, I want to manually change it so it looks worse? Is there someone on the planet you think like that? Maybe
I think people who are in sports bars who want to make sure that it's always in sports mode and always at 120 hertz, they might say.
It will be.
Well, I don't know. If you know... Write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com.
All right, let's go on to, is it Quibi? How do you say it? Do we know?
Quibi, yes.
Quibi, not Quibi, but Quibi. Like, don't
yes.
quibble, it's pronounced Quibi. Okay.
Yeah, like quick bites.
That's right, quick bites, Quibi. Okay. Well, then
well,
it'll
this
be Quibi.
Quick buy.
Oh, bite, Quibi. Quibi.
Oh, yeah, Quibi. It's not a ribeye steak. It's all right, it's a platform, a streaming video platform, started by Jeffrey Katzen. I'm sorry?
With no purpose.
With no purpose. Okay. It's started by Jeffrey Katzenberg, and Meg Whitman is the CEO, and they are basically creating video content, short, little bites of video content, 5 minutes, 10 minutes tops.
And they came to CES, the Consumer Electronics Show, and everybody was saying, okay, why not just put this stuff on YouTube? What's the point of your platform? Why do you have to have a whole new service other than the fact, of course, that if you make people come to your service, you get to charge them money. You get to control them. You get their information. You get their metadata. You get to charge them. So yeah, you could put your stuff on YouTube, but then YouTube gets a cut. You could put your short film on iTunes or Apple TV, whatever it's called now, but then they get a cut. So, of course, they want their own platform for their short films. And they're explaining the allure and excitement of their platform and how cool it's going to be. And they announced
and 175 short form series they'll make in the first year.
Right. They got lots of filmmakers, lots of talented people. And you know what? When they come up with something that's really fun and clever, which I imagine they will, in like any platform, if they finally get a hit show or something really creative, people will come and check it out. And, you know, if they can they'll have a good service.
And to your point, Meg Whitman, and this is a quote that she said, YouTube is the most ubiquitous, democratized, incredibly creative platform, but they make content for hundreds of dollars a minute. We make it for $100,000 a minute. It's a whole different
I'm
level.
I'm sorry, Meg. I go to YouTube and look at movie trailers, which are movies that cost hundreds of millions of dollars. So no, not all their content costs 10 bucks. I watch music videos, which can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars. So no, you're lying and you're wrong. You're lying.
Well, look, she has to make her. She's lying.
They do not make content. A lot of the content there comes from Saturday Night Live and The Daily Show. It's high quality, expensive content. It's clips from TV. It's movies. It's film trailers. It's music videos. This is all a very expensive content. It is not junk made on the cheap. So you're wrong. That's the first thing I would say to her. Well, that's not true, Meg, because some of the most popular stuff on YouTube are music videos. They don't cost pennies. Neither.
Well, first of all, Quibi has raised $1.4 billion. Oh my gosh, who gave them $1.4 billion? Why did you give them $1.4 billion? But they're going to try and launch April 6th, and they're going to charge $5 per month to watch their short form videos.
$5 a month, you can get Disney Plus.
Exactly. I was like, $5 a month? I don't think you can do this.
Yeah, you should be ad supported.
And I believe they are going to be partially ad supported as well.
What, you mean you can access it but look at ads?
Correct.
Well, then that's not $5 a month. Then it's multi-level platform where one, because that's not what it says. It says it costs $5 a month. It doesn't say, you know, you get to choose your level.
Yeah,
it's one or the other.
Well, that said, you have a problem, not with any of you have a problem with all this stuff, but you have a problem with their patent pending technology.
What is
turnstile?
It?
Turnstile. Well, turnstile is like when you go into the subway station.
No, you have a metro.
Oh, it's not. Oh no, it's if you're watching one of their quick bites, one of their videos, and you have it in portrait mode. Well, it looks like a video that is in portrait mode. Actually, it looks like a video in portrait mode. But then when you turn it landscape, it turns into a landscape video.
Right. So
it's two different videos for the same content.
Right, so you shoot a content, you have to have two versions because they don't want any black bars. So they want it to work either way you're looking at your phone, whether they think it's exciting because it's in portrait mode or landscape mode, or it's exciting to have two versions, or they think people hate black bars because you don't need black bars if it's meant to be in landscape mode. You're looking in portrait mode, you go, oh, you turn your phone and then you're looking in landscape mode. Like a million video games, there are some video games that get played vertically. You know, you're climbing a ladder, or they're played horizontally. Mario is going from left to right. You know, so people tilt their phones. When I see people on the subways looking at TV content, if they're looking at The Daily Show, they might have that in portrait mode or landscape mode. It doesn't really matter. But when they're looking at Game of Thrones on their phone, like they do sometimes, they turn their phone on its side, right? Because it's getting more of the picture and they can see a bigger image, and that's the way they do it.
You know what would be a true patent-pending technology?
Well, yeah, I don't know why it's a patent-pending.
If I turn the... If I tilt the phone and all the actors slide to the one side.
There you go. But yeah, just like an old Star Trek TV show. You know, you shake the screen or shake the camera and they all have to go, oh!
So, right.
So, I mean, they've got all this great talent, and now they're telling them, oh, you have to have two completely visual differences for your TV show.
Like, yeah, creatives love it.
I actually thought about what it should look like, and I want it to look like A, not A or B. I want to look like A. So I don't get this at all. I think it seems annoying to the filmmakers. It's moronic in terms of your audience. Like, you're worried they won't know which way to watch something, or that they'll get insulted if they, oh, I got to turn to landscape mode again. I don't get it. It's the dumbest thing I've heard.
Well, and we were kind of going back and forth before we started recording. And I said, look, the only thing I could see this being useful for is if you had like a detective show and you had to rewatch the footage and see like what you're missing in portrait mode. Like, do you get like clues to the mystery if you're not in a certain mode? You know, if you're in landscape mode, you don't get the clues. Or
that's why you tell them which mode to watch it in.
Right. So
yeah, it seemed to me it's pretty dumb. And if I'm a filmmaker, I would hate it.
Do you think this idea is DOA?
I do. And no, I don't think it's DOA. Well, yes, I do. I do think a lot of filmmakers would be like, what are you talking about? I have a vision of how this should look. And it's not two different looks, you know?
Well, you know, somebody who had a vision for what I thought would have been a great sequel, by the way, The Graduate 2. Okay. Plastics. Plastics. Buck Henry. Remember The Player in 1994? He spent the first 10 minutes of the film, which was a single tracking shot that was shot literally in a single tracking shot. Those were the days where visual effects did not help you when you had a single shot.
Yeah. 1917.
Yeah. Buck Henry, he was a writer. He was an actor. And he...
Director.
Co-director. And a director. He died at the age of 89, but he was in the first 10 minutes of that movie pitching to Tim Robbins the idea for The Graduate 2.
Right,
and he was following him around the lot trying to pitch this idea because he co-wrote the screenplay for The Graduate and What's Up, Doc? With Peter Bogdanovich, by the way. He wrote the screenplay for To Die For, and he actually starred in that movie. He co-created Get Smart. Did he direct Heaven Can Wait?
Heaven Can Wait with Warren Beatty.
Yeah, so he did Catch 22, and he was on Saturday Night Live.
Oh, wow. He was on the host like 10 times in the first 2 years. I mean, they had him on all the time.
So this was, look, it is a real loss. He wasn't very active lately, but... He's 89.
What can I say? The buck stops here. His mother, but he had a fun Hollywood history. I didn't know this. Buck Henry's mom was a silent film star, and his dad was an Air Force general and stockbroker. Like, way to rebel against your father. And he once punked Walter Cronkite. He created this jokey thing called the Society for Indecency to Naked Animals. And they used to campaign against allowing animals to be naked. They thought it was horrible. And, you know, dogs should not be walking around naked, showing their willies, you know. And one of their slogans was, a nude horse is a rude horse. And Walter Cronkite did a story on the evening news, not realizing it was a joke. And he interviewed Buck Henry, and he never forgave him for not telling him it was a joke. So that's kind of funny. But yeah, he had an interesting career for sure. On the gravestone, of course, is The Graduate, but a lot of fun, interesting stuff.
Well, you know, there was a filmmaker that I am friends with on the Facebook, okay? And I'm trying to remember who it was that... It was Tom DiCillo, or Tom DiCello, okay? And he was saying that he was selected in 1990 for the Sundance Directors Lab for his screenplay, Johnny Suede. Uh-huh. And he gets up to Utah, to the Sundance Filmmakers Lab. And the first day, he sits down and he's given this, this filmmaker, very well-known filmmaker, wearing a Panavision hat and a silver goatee. And he says, your plot points don't lead to one another. It's just your horrible screenplay. There's no plot point. This filmmaker, Tom DiCillo, he said, I stared at him a moment and said, I'm sorry, what's a plot point? And the next morning, he's still like reeling from this horrible start to this. He met with Buck Henry, and he's still, obviously gun shy from yesterday's, quote unquote advice. And, Buck Henry sits down with his little briefcase, and Buck Henry gives him a sly grin and said, I loved your script. It's crazy, but it has something quite original. Trust it. It's going to make a great movie. And whatever you do, don't listen to any of these other F-wads.
Also dying this week is Neil Peart of Rush. He died at 67 of a horrible form of brain cancer. What a shame. One of the great drummers of all time. He's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame with the band Rush, of course. He's with the band for 45 years. I was 8 when he joined Rush. I mean, that's just crazy. Hugely influential drummer and lyricist for the band. Drew a lot early on from sci-fi and Ayn Rand, but no. They're not right-wingers. They're Canadian. He calls himself a bleeding heart libertarian. They won awards from fans in Modern Drummer 38 times over the years. They loved Neil Peart. I love this quote from Stuart Copeland. He said, Neil is the most air-drummed two drummer of all time. More people have air-drummed to Neil Peart than anyone else in history. I think that's kind of awesome. And I want to offer condolences to his family and friends and my friend Brian Scarry, because believe me, huge Rush fan. I'm not joking here. Traveled the country to go see Rush in concert many, many times, all over the country to see them. You know, when bands are around for 45 years, they can mean a lot to people. And it really is a big impact when somebody that you have been following for decades dies. So it's a sad way to go with brain cancer, but what a great career.
And I can tell you that all of the Rush fans that I knew were Rush fans back in high school, they all popped up on Facebook this past week with posts about this, including some who had bands. And I wondered, I was like, oh, yeah, I remember, you know, they had that band, that high school band that covered Rush. And sure enough, they posted recordings of that band on SoundCloud as a tribute. But, you know, Neil Peart, he was, he was like a modern day warrior. He had a mean stride. He was today's Tom Sawyer.
I don't know that he wrote those lyrics, but yeah, he's a fun band and a great career. But, they survived under a lot of pressure. And sometimes the pressure gets to be too much. Hollywood is not a friendly place.
And unfortunately, here's one that really is a gut punch. Silvio Horta. And if that name doesn't sound familiar, he had a show that he made called Ugly Betty. He did both the Spanish version and the ABC series Ugly Betty. He died at the age of 45.
And he had a good career. He was doing other shows. He had sci-fi shows. He had a number of shows in different levels. But he obviously never matched the success of Ugly Betty.
It's a real shame.
He did not create the original series. He adapted the original series.
I
didn't think that was true. But apparently, as we can tell, he died by suicide. So that is really tough. You know, he was the showrunner. It ran 4 seasons. You know what? That's a great achievement for a lifetime. You launched multiple careers. You had a hit show that everybody knows. It's a shame that they will. What have you done today? You know, it's like you're writing a novel. They're like, well, when's your next novel coming out? it's the pressure to keep continuing and topping yourself. I guess it's understandable, but it's ugly and sad to see that somebody who had such a great success felt like it wasn't enough. But obviously, it's not about the pressures of the world, because a lot of people face those pressures, but. You know, hopefully when they suffer these health issues, that they'll get help.
Do you know William Gibson, the author?
Oh, sure, yeah.
So in the book review this past, New York Times book review this past week, he had a quote that I wrote down. He said, after a certain point in one's career, the worry that they'll finally notice your true absence of talent morphs into worrying that they'll finally notice that you've lost it.
Wow. Yeah, no, it's the pretender syndrome, right? That a lot of
imposter syndrome. Yeah, syndrome,
that's right. Well, one person that didn't suffer that, she was kind of behind the scenes for most of her career. I had never heard of her, knew nothing about her. But once you dig into what she had accomplished, I just got an email about her. I don't know if she's even gotten a bit in the Times or anywhere, but it's music promoter and PR person Nancy Lewis Jones. The PR firm Bono Brian Brown is the one that sent out a press release saying that she had died. And I'm thankful to them, because what a fascinating career. She was a trailblazer who quietly pushed along many careers with persistence and charm. She was coming out of college. She got a job offer at NBC News, and she turned it down to travel the world. She wanted to, you know, have her gap year, have fun first. She didn't get past London. She and a friend were going to go all over the world, but London was in the midst of the swinging 60s, and she said, this is great. She stayed right.
Did she say, this is great, baby?
Exactly. She did everything from contribute to music magazines, to working at record labels, to working at Rogers & Cowan PR firm, but she was always promoting the artists she loved. Pete Townsend said The Who would not have done as well as fast if it weren't for Nancy. She worked the London office for The Who. Then she opened up their American office and helped them launch their first big tour. She got the Tommy, performed at the Met. She worked with George Clinton, who went on, of course, a huge career in music. They worked together on The Who, but she also bought tons of soul records when she was in Detroit, and she brought them back to England and passed them around to everyone. George Clinton says she is uniquely responsible for introducing Northern Soul to the UK. That's a movement that continues to this day. They champion U.S. soul music, especially with less well-known artists, you know, like not the big Motown and Stax people, but all these acts that you and I have never heard of. Northern Soul is a hugely influential genre and experience, and nightclubs to this day do it. And I had no idea that she was involved in all this. She also championed Genesis. Peter Gabriel says she was there for them and made things happen when they needed it the most. They were utterly unknown in the US. And Monty Python, utterly unknown in the United States. But the label she worked at, I think it was Buddha, got the rights to two of their albums. Nobody heard of them. Nobody cared. She hadn't actually watched the TV show in the UK, but she was aware of them. And she played the albums and they made her laugh. And so on her own, she just said, by God, I'm going to champion them. And she just started going to...
Apparently, she got a British accent while she was over there.
Absolutely. She would go to college radio stations and indie DJs and convince them and say, you've got to play this. It's hilarious. This was back in the day when they would play comedy bits on the radio. But they're like, British humor? That won't work. Americans won't get it. She convinced them. Tastemakers all over the U.S. embraced the group. And she was described as, quote, pleasantly relentless. And she finally broke them long after the Pythons themselves and everyone else gave up. And she was also key later on marketing their films, Monty Python and the Holy Grail, and Monty Python's Life of Brian. There are so many people in the industry that do this work and champion people and never get mentioned. They're in marketing, they're in PR, they're in all these areas, and they have great taste, and they make careers happen, and they really help people, and they really matter. So it's nice to see Nancy Lewis Jones get her due here.
Well, also passing away, Ivan Passer.
Have you ever?
Yeah. He's a leading figure of the Czech New Wave. So he was a filmmaker who, by the way, would not make a violent film. That was like one of his claims to fame. Because, you know, he said he saw way too much violence during World War II.
That's right. He's probably best known in the U.S. for Cutter's Way. That's a classic film. I have never seen it. Have you?
No, I have not.
Right.
I've heard of it, never seen it.
Right. He was a friend of Miloš Forman. They met in boarding school. And like you say, he refused to make violent films. And he said that sort of hurt his career a bit. There were so many movies like, no, I don't want to do this. I don't want to do that. And in fact, he ended up teaching film at USC. That was part of his later career. With Miloš Forman's passing a little recently, a lot of people were talking to Ivan Passer. He had some lovely stories and anecdotes to share. And I'm glad he lived long enough to find out that his movie, Cutter's Way, did make the list of the IRIS films of the best 100 movies of the 1980s. The IRIS are a group I've been taking part in since the early 90s. They've been getting together for 45 years now, something like that, since the mid-70s, talking about the best films of the year. There are Oscar-winning film directors who have been in the IRIS, best-selling authors who've written about Hollywood history and biographies, studio PR heads, film critics, people at top magazines like Premiere. So all sorts of cool people and me belong to the IRAs. And we are now voting on the best films of the 1980s. We've done a whole rounds of voting. We now have 100 movies. So now I'm going to go look at movies like Cutter's Way that I've never seen. There's about 10 that I have never seen or need to see again. And then we'll rank them and find out what the best film of the 80s is. But if you're wondering how many of those movies you've seen, come to our website and you can see the list of the 100 films that begin with After Hours and ends with Zelig. And you will find Cutter's Way on that list along with a lot of other great movies.
But not Terminator.
No, it just missed the cut. Terminator was almost on there. Terminator 2, of course, would be 1990. That, to me, is the greater of the films in the franchise. But Terminator's a fun movie. There will always be. My friend looked at the list and said, where's Pretty in Pink? Well, you know, there's Berlin Alexander Plots and Koyaanisqatsi, but there's also, you know, Mad Max 2, The Road Warrior, and My Favorite Year with Peter O'Toole, and Raiders of the Lost Ark, and Raging Bull, and E.T., and Pritzi's Honor. So I'm sure you've seen a lot of the films, but if there's some you haven't, you should check them out.
Yes, and thank you for checking us out each week, and we hope you will subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can rate and review our show in any one of those podcast aggregators. It helps us out when you do. It helps other people find the show when you rate and review us. And that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find those ways to contact us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox. We're on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Again, all that information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it is, I will work on how to pronounce Indian names and titles. I will work on how to pronounce Indian names and titles.com.
Okay, well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.